All right, well, there's been a bit of a plague of pestilence, a plague of rats and mice, and I thought, well, the man to talk to
is the Pied Piper of Hamlet.
The Pied Piper, Andy Spence. How are you, Andy?
I'm very well, thank you.
Yeah, so there has been people have noticed that the rats and mice have been coming in.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's been a pretty hard summer for them, I reckon. You know, there's nothing out there to eat. All the fruit's dropped off the trees. And coming autumn, of course, they're getting a bit cold and starting to get a bit damp. So your house looks like a good place to live.
Yeah. So they do tend to come in. I noticed that the blood and bone in my garden cupboard had a good going.
Yeah, anything edible.
Yeah.
Even if it's only vaguely edible, they'd be into.
Yeah.
I got a job on this lady's house, and her house was absolutely infested with mice. They were through. She just moved in, so there's piles of clothes everywhere, and the mice were all through her clothes, you know, and doing what they do in them.
Yeah.
So lots of little bait stations around the house for her.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, is that we've got, what's the word I'm looking for? We want to try to avoid getting them in the first place, and then we've got to get rid of them once they're there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, let's talk about both those things. I mean,
right.
So first of all, avoiding getting the little critters to start with.
Yeah, as few holes in your house as possible.
Right.
You know,
doors and windows don't help them.
Yeah, I mean, they'll get into anything, any little cracks in the floorboard. So if you've got any obvious holes, then patch them up so they can't get into easily.
Yeah.
Keep food away from, you know, so there's no available food in the house. Make it more attractive for them to be outside than in the house. If you've got all your foods in jars and there's nothing that they can get into, then it makes it harder for them.
Yeah, and then I suppose you want bait stations around as well.
I reckon a bait station on every property would be a good idea. You know, you have those grids that dock when they set them up. Like when we were at the when I was at the park, we had grids right through the park, 100 meter grids by 50 meters. So no rat had to go further than 50 meters to find a bait, basically.
Right, is that their kind of foraging range? Is it about 50
meters?
Yeah,
by 50 meters.
Yeah.
So if you have that, then you keep the numbers really low. I mean, you don't get rid of them entirely, but you get them to a level where they don't cause any problems to native birds and so forth. And that equates to about one bait station per two properties. So you don't even have to have one per property, but so it's not much, really, that's needed.
No. And, I mean, what is it? I mean, you know, if I was a rat, and I'm thinking, well, here's a bit of green stuff in a plastic tube, and here's a bag of oats, I might be more inclined to go for the oats, wouldn't I?
Yeah, probably would. They make that stuff taste really good, though. The one we used to use was the Pestoff. It was blue little baits, and it used to smell of chocolate. It was actually quite sort of and they used to like that stuff. They would choose that stuff. It's made with bryophacum, which is quite long lasting in the environment. And there's a changeover at the moment to different type of anticoagulants, but they have to be kept completely stocked all the time, so a little bit more difficult to use.
And you've got to tie the stuff down too, don't you?
Yeah, you don't want them to take it away, because otherwise they'll take 16 blocks and put it down their nest, and then they'll die after eating one of them, and you've wasted 15 baits down the nest, basically, and spread it around the environment as well. So you put it in a bait station that keeps it locked in place, either by a wire or a nail. You can get the proper bait stations from Fillproof. That's the ones that Doc recommend. You go on to the wet and net and go Fillproof bait stations. You want the little mini rat bait stations. And then you can put the blocks inside on the spikes, and then the rats have to come in and eat it in situ, and then they go away and die. Works for mice as well.
But don't they die under the house and make a big smell?
Yeah, they can do.
Yeah.
I've got some at home at the moment that have died in my workshop downstairs, and I've got this huge pile of cardboard on there, and I'm sure they're dead on the bottom of this huge pile of cardboard.
Yeah.
But, that's the disadvantage. You can use the traps, but...
I was going to ask you about traps. I mean, do traps work? I mean...
No, they can do. I mean, you're only going to get one at a time, you know, one mouse at a time. But, I mean, that's one way of doing it. If you're prepared to bait them and dispose of the little furry bodies, then that's another way of going.
Yeah.
Or you hear them squeaking in the middle of the night because you've got one leg, you know. And so there's problems with both of them. If you're really anti-bait, then, you know, go for the traps.
And there's different theories about what you should put on your traps as well, I think, isn't it? I mean, you know,
Cheese is the old one.
Yeah.
They don't like cheese.
Right.
Peanut butter's much better.
Okay.
Chocolate buttons is really good.
Yeah.
Bacon is another one.
Right. Okay.
But, all the bait they use these days is peanut butter based, because that's their real love is peanut butter.
Right.
Goodness knows where they like peanuts from, but there you
yeah,
go.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's very high on nutrition, isn't it? So,
yeah. Very oily.
Yep.
And chocolate, well, everybody likes chocolate. Serotonin producing, so even rats and mice like serotonin.
Why? Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
They get happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So smearing peanut butter over your traps is the way to go.
Yeah, you just put a little dab of peanut butter on the bait tongue or whatever it's called, you know, and then they sit on that and get their heads chomped.
Yeah. Now, you were talking about, you know, the infestations and the going through the clothes and stuff like that. I mean, apart from being a bit gross and, you know, and people, a lot of people, especially with rats, are kind of quite a fear of them. But, I mean, are there other health issues that arise from having them around?
No, I suppose it would be if they were going down the sewers and stuff like that. But most of these ones are just living outside in your garden, so I don't think there's that much to worry about in terms of infections or whatever.
But they will eat plastic, won't they? Like plastic around wiring and stuff.
Particularly if you've got something in the plastic they want, they'll chew right through the bucket to get it. But if they're left up in the roof there, they'll sort of idly chew through your wiring. I don't know, quite a few people, they, you know, their oven clocks stop working. You know, you take the back of the oven off and there's this petrified mouse standing in a frozen position after being electrocuted in the back of the stove because it's eaten through the wires. You know?
Wow.
I've had that a couple of times. Jeez. Little skeleton standing there.
You know? And I suppose the problem is that people must contact you at a point of desperation when things have already got really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the time I just tell people how to do it themselves.
Yeah.
Because it's not difficult, it's just people lack the sort of basic understanding of how it works. But, you know, if you've got a big block of land, it helps to have somebody come in and set it up for you and show you where they should go and how you need to. It doesn't take long. I mean, it takes me a few hours to set somebody up with a proper bait run system, and then they can maintain it themselves.
Yeah. And how often do you need to check these things and change the bait if you're doing it?
Once a week if you're using Bedifacoum. Because it takes a week for them to die after eating a lethal dose. So there's no point in giving them a lethal dose the second day. You know, so put one lot of bait out, let them eat it. Then a week later, put out more. And then you're getting any rats and mice that haven't been killed by the first lot.
And should you put the bait by the stuff that they're going to eat? Like, you know, I was talking about blood and bone. Do I put the bait station next to the blood and bone? Or, you know, if they're in the compost, do I put it next to the compost? Or do I put it somewhere else?
I put it right next to the compost.
Yeah.
I mean, right near where they're living. You know, you've got the best chance of them seeing it that way.
Yeah.
That's sensible.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to go home and do that this afternoon.
Oh, okay. Good. Mice are a little bit more difficult than rats. You need more than one bait station per two properties to get mice, because their territories, I'm told, can be as small as 5 meters in an area where there's lots of food. So in your house, you need to put, you know, a bait station in each room to start with, you know, until you've got the numbers down.
Mm. Yeah, okay. And there's the little ones, eh? Little
and then, of course, then people swear by cats as a way of getting their rats and mice under control. It's not my recommendation, because I'm a bit of a bird lover. And I was just saying to Alex and Alan as I was going out, that if somebody could breed a cat that only ate rats and mice and was absolutely paranoid of birds, they could probably make a good living out of that. You know, just get a bird a cat that starts to shake every time it sees a bird and just goes for the rats and mice.
And people do swear by it, though, don't they? And I think, you know, do you think that's just a bit of kind of blindness to the reality of it? Like, oh, you know, my cat doesn't eat birds, only eats rats and mice.
Yeah, well, we don't see most of what a cat eats, because most of it gets eaten out there. And they eat lots of skinks and geckos and any little thing they can get hold of. And birds are part of their menu. So, you know, if they don't bring it home, doesn't mean they haven't eaten it.
Yeah. And the bait stations, I mean, obviously they're designed so that it's the rats and mice that are getting in there and not people and dogs and so on. But are there, what about insects and stuff like that? Are they being affected by this stuff?
I've seen, what do you call them? Gosh, wetters. inside the traps. So I presume that they're eating it. It's not particularly lethal to other things, but it's particularly lethal to vertebrates because it works on the anticoagulants in the blood. So basically, when the rat and mouse eats the poison, what it does is it bleeds internally. It's said not to be a painful death, and the ones I've seen dying, it just sort of got really weak and slower and slower. So it's in a very local area. If it did have an effect on the insects, it should be very local.
Yeah. All right.
I mean, it's not ideal. The ideal is to get rid of them all and have a rat-free island, but the chances of doing that on somewhere the size of Waiheke are pretty
slim. That's a big job, isn't it?
Yeah. It'd be a huge thing.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a good tip there, Andy. Thank you for that.
Yeah,
now, we're also going to talk about something quite different as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we get into that time of year, you know, October, the local board election comes up, and you stood for the, not for the by-election, but for the last board election, and did, you know, well, but not well enough, I have to say.
Yeah, that was five votes.
Five votes, and then, you know, didn't stand for the by-election after kind of thinking, well, we didn't want to split the vote and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But it is that kind of time when people are starting to indicate that they're wanting to stand for the next election. So I thought, well, while we're here, I'll ask you if you're going to stand again.
Well, I've given it a lot of thought. And I've been coming and hiring and coming and going, and some people have said, you know, oh, Andy, you must stand. And I said, yeah, well, you know, 3 years ago I was just, you know, just finished a job and I had lots of time and lots of space, and that was the ideal time to set into something new. And now my life is full of business and choir and all sorts of other things. Where would I fit this into my greater scheme of life and so on, you know? So that's a big question in my mind. Just actually, how much time or how would I fit it into what I'm already doing? What would I drop off, you know? And I see Paul there. I mean, the amount of time Paul puts into talking to people and getting involved, it's very inspiring. Yeah, so that's where I'm sort of at my thinking at the moment.
Yeah. And although I suppose one of the things, maybe, you know, looking at Paul, for example, was there was a lot of time and a lot of effort put in, but perhaps not that much result coming out the other end.
Yeah, well, that sounds very unfortunate. I mean, I've been to board meetings where Paul's the lone voice crying in the wilderness, and it feels like a waste of time. But I really think that representing what people want is the most, you know, important part of being a politician, not necessarily getting the policy in place, but actually representing what people are actually trying to achieve. And, you know, my view on politics is very much that it's about taking what people want and representing it to the council. I mean, what I see on the board is that they get a bunch of policies and plans to vote on, and they vote on that. But actually, what is needed from the island tends to take second place. It's not like it's ground-up politics. And the way I see politics is very much in a ground-up approach.
It does seem that one of the issues we have, and it's probably not unique to the island, but is just, the background kind of jiggery-pokery which goes on before we even get to the candidates on the list. You know, there was certainly around the by-election, I know that you had quite intense discussions with people about, you know, just who should stand. And
It's going on now.
Yeah.
The same thing. I mean, the more community-driven candidate brigade is trying to avoid a replay of last time's 12 sort of left-wingish candidates standing for what was conceivably really only two or three places on the board, given who else was standing. And if we had the same thing again this time, it'll split the vote, and again we'll have an unfair distribution of politics represented on the board.
Yeah, so, I mean, how do you go about avoiding that? But, I mean, you know, the personalities must play a large part in that. I mean, you know, there's not going to be anyone who's kind of putting themselves forward who goes, you know, actually, probably I'm the person who shouldn't stand up.
I mean, one of the little sayings I've liked most is if you want to stand for politics, you should actually automatically be disqualified as being unsuitable. So, you know, it's just this that you need an ego, you know, to stand up there and say, I'm the person you should vote for. But do we really want to vote for people who want to stand up and say, I'm the kind of person you should vote for? So, yeah, and I liked Alex's suggestion. You know, really, what we want is the kind of people to be put forward who the community thinks would be a good person to represent them. So, you know, who does the community want to be representing them on the board, rather than people standing up and saying, vote for me, I'm best.
So, I mean, having been one of the people who's been involved in those kind of discussions, you know, to work out who should stand, I mean, what actually goes on? I mean, what does it get down to? It is it just kind of a, in the end, is it the person who goes, well, no matter what, I'm going to do this, or is it a more kind of civilized, you know, discussion that takes place around the merits of various positions and people, or you know, how does it actually go?
Well, it doesn't seem to be that popular a thing to put yourself forward for. You know, you've got to be in a position to have enough time and also feel that you've got something to contribute. And I think if you've got enough sincerity or enough intelligence, you probably think that my contribution perhaps isn't as valuable as I think it is. So the discussions have been more around the kind of policies and how candidates should be chosen, rather than people jumping up and down saying, choose me.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it's something you're still thinking about, obviously.
Yeah. I thought I'd made up a complete mind not to, but I haven't yet.
Right. Mm. All right. As a watch this space.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Well, thanks very much for popping in, Andy.
Yeah, thank you. And well, can I give a plug for May the 11th? We've got, and 12th, we've got the Waiheke Choral Society doing two Mozart masses at the Catholic Church in the afternoon. And we've been practicing these for 6 months. We've got some soloists coming over from town, and it should be an incredibly moving performance.
What time is that?
I think it's 2 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday at the Catholic Church. And in the evening at Rocky Bay, there's V12 singing some of their old numbers and some of their new Beatles repertoire, which we're practicing for a Beatles concert in September.
Oh, good stuff.
So I'm in both of those.
Yeah.
Come along.
You can have a dry throat by the
end of... Oh, God, the end of May the 11th, I'll have a big on sing, yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, thanks very much, Andy.
Thank you.